Leonard and Elon, you know, Trump is turning on a lot of, there's
it's like, remember Mary Trump's book?
Yeah, what was it?
The title was something, Too Much and Never Enough, or something like it. You can never satisfy this narcissistic appetite of Donald Trump, because there'll always be something else that he'll want from you that you can't give him or won't give him, and then he'll turn on you.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to George Conway Explains It All to Sarah. I'm Sarah Longwell, publisher of The Borg, and because I'm not a lawyer, I've asked my good friend George Conway from the Society for the Rule of Law.
Say moi.
That's you, to explain all the illegal news to me, and guess
illegal.
What?
Illegal.
So I was like, oh, I wonder what George and I are going to talk about. You know, like yesterday morning, you know, I was talking about it with the producers.
What usually happens is we show up here and there are like five illegal things from breakfast on.
Yeah, well, this is what he did last night. Because this is, okay, so we're recording on Thursday, and last night we get a handful of
We should just put a clock here so that people know, like,
what time it is.
Yes, like the illegal clock.
It's Thursday afternoon, and therefore anything that happens this evening or Friday that's a little, sorry,
you are
we didn't
on
get to
your
it.
Own.
Yeah, you're on your own. But don't worry, we got a lot of insane directives last night.
The odds are they will be illegal, okay?
So. True.
You know, that's our advice to you.
So first, I want to talk about Trump's presidential memorandum ordering an investigation into Joe Biden. Specifically, the White House ordered an investigation into who ran the United States while President Biden was in office, including whether certain individuals conspired to deceive the public about Biden's mental state and unconstitutionally exercised the authorities and responsibilities of the president. Okay. So even if this is completely frivolous and asinine, like it's just
crazy. We got Weekend at Donnie's going on right now. And come on.
But like, I guess when I saw this and I saw they were invested, I was like, are we in a weird world where Biden is suddenly glad that he has that presidential immunity? Because like, can't Trump not do anything?
No, I don't think they're directing. The presidential immunity is a protection against civil liability and criminal prosecution for a president. But what Trump is trying to do here, it's a stunt.
It's a stunt. Yeah.
But he's professing to call into question the legitimacy of any number of things that Biden did. And it's kind of a variation on the auto pen angle. And mm-hmm. I think did they mention the auto pen in this one? I think they may. But the question is like, okay, he was just signing stuff using an auto pen, which is just. There's an OLC.
What's an auto pen?
An auto pen is just basically a machine that you can program to mimic your signature.
Okay.
And you know, politicians use it all the time. They use it, you know, when you get a letter back from the White House saying thank you for your nice postcard, you know, or you're a little kid and you get something back. That's all auto pen.
Okay.
But presidents have used auto pens to sign actual stuff. It happened during the Bush administration, and the question became like, well, can we actually do this? The second Bush administration, George W., and two OLC memos, one written by Ed Whalen, came to the conclusion that, yeah, because what the framers understood to be signing, and that's the basis of the question of presidents signing a bill, for example, you're affixing a signature, but it doesn't require your using a pen. You can have Barry sign for you if you authorize it.
Never let our producer
Barry
sign anything.
You can have a thumbprint. You can do, you know, there's any number of ways you can affix something that basically represents you mm-hmm. onto a document. And the framers viewed it that broadly. And that's what the U.S. Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel memoranda, that's the office in the Justice Department that gives legal opinions to the president, they said it's perfectly legal. And it was legal then. Obama did it. Trump did it. And and Biden has done it. The only difference is that they're pretending that, oh, well, there was an auto pen used by Biden, even though we've done it. Biden was non-corpus menace or something.
Remember when Trump signed all the COVID checks? He didn't hand sign those, I presume.
No.
So
that was just probably just like printed. They were probably printed pre-affixed on there. But the question is judicial commissions for political appointments, bills, proclamations, things that, you know, normally you see the president's signature on. A president can do all of that using subordinates as long or machines, as long as he personally gives the direction to have that done. Like, yes, I approve that. Just use the auto pen or you can sign it. They usually don't. It's usually an auto pen. So there's nothing this is all bullshit.
So when you say it's a stunt, because there is sort of a pernicious aspect to it, because one of the things in the memo, it acknowledges, like it talks about Biden's 235 federal judges. So doesn't it, that is trying to cast doubt on whether or not they were legitimately appointed.
Correct.
Then.
And they're never going to get those commissions struck down. Okay. The judicial commissions. They're never going to be able to undo something unless you had an actual, and I don't even know. I don't know. I don't think there's ever been a judicial decision on it that I know of. You'd have to show at a minimum, assuming it was possible to undo something that a president has done by auto pen or delegation of a signature, you'd have to show that the president actually did not give the direction. And I think there would be a strong presumption that if the president's signature is affixed to it and people are saying that was the president's signature, it was authorized, you don't really want to get into looking behind that. So it's a stunt.
But to what end?
First of all, it creates a buzz about Biden. Right? Because, this is like Marie talking about Hillary's emails. This is the new Hillary's emails.
Sure.
And they like the fact that people are talking about Biden and not the crazy things that they're doing day in and day out. That's why they're all excited about the book, that recent book, even though that book actually didn't report in that much that was new, as I understand it. But they love talking about Biden, just as they, in 2017, they love talking, 2018, 2017, they love talking about Hillary.
Yeah. This is a way in which they go on offense. We talk a lot about the asymmetric nature of the parties.
Yeah.
Like, you didn't see Biden talking tons about Trump.
No, he didn't talk enough about Trump.
Yeah, I know.
I mean, that's been our, drumbeat for years.
Yeah.
It's like, you need to talk about this guy who tried to destroy the country and destroy the Constitution. And he wouldn't do it for a while.
Yeah.
And then he did it. He did it well a couple of times, and then he dropped it again.
Yeah.
And here we are.
So, all right. So that's all this is. This is just Trump
bullshit.
Trying to.
I keep saying that word. That's a legal term.
Can he do anything to Biden or the people?
No, he's not going to do anything to Biden. I think if Biden was not mentally capable of signing something, he can't be held liable for that or criminally. So it's not really a question of immunity. It would be the question of whether or not the government could theoretically, this government, this regime, could take the position that things done in the prior administration were not actually done by and on behalf of the president. So that's the angle they're coming at it with. But it's ridiculous fantasy. It's performative.
But what's the mechanism by which they do this? They have the Department of Justice is now going to investigate. Like, are they going to subpoena people around Biden?
Who knows? I mean, they issue these things and you actually don't know whether it's just for show or whether they'll just do a few steps here and there. We don't know. Okay. I mean, we don't know. I mean, they change their mind. They go from this to that the next moment, here today, tariffs, tomorrow, no tariff, this. They're like an out of control fire hose that just is pointing in every single direction. And that's how they operate. And that's how, it's consistent with Trump's personality defects. And it's consistent with their political strategy of just throwing shit in every direction. What was the phrase that Bannon used?
Flood the zone.
Flood the zone. Yeah. Just do crazy shit left and right and confuse everybody and distract everybody. Keep all these balls in the air.
No, they are good at that.
They
that
are good
it.
At that.
That is
but
it.
That's,
that is
it helps being, a bunch of sociopaths, I bet.
Yeah, but it's also, now we're off a little bit, but this is sort of when Hannah Arendt talks about, when a citizenry doesn't know how to distinguish
reality
truth
from
fact, right?
Yeah.
Or truth and fiction or whatever. Right. They can't distinguish reality. Then you can't choose between right and wrong.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's a very, very common theme in writings and studies of authoritarianism, It's just that it becomes too tiresome to figure out what's real, what's factual, what's not. And you have a large section of the country that's just, oh, it sees this stuff on Facebook and one thing says that and the other thing says that. It's like, I don't know if anything's true. Whatever. And they become kind of agnostic as to reality. And that's a very dangerous situation that for a democracy.
Yeah. Okay.
We're getting very philosophical.
We are. Well, I'm trying to drop.
But we need like Tim Snyder here and, exactly.
All right. We're going to do our first ad, pay some bills. With Donald Trump back in office, the constant churn of dispiriting news can make following politics more of a chore. I know some of you feel that way. So someone should really make it easier. Someone not just us at The Bulwark. And that's why NPR Politics Podcast is where I go to decode what is going on in Washington and what every decision that comes out of this town might mean for me and for you. Every day, NPR Politics team focuses on one thing. They boil it down. They do it in 15 minutes or less. It's like a political multivitamin. It's that quick and that easy, and we all know we got to take our multivitamins. So I love NPR Politics Podcast. I listen to it every day. I like that the content is nice and tight, and it helps me quickly brush up to do my podcasts every week. And believe it or not, it was the first podcast taping, like a live podcast taping, really? That I ever attended.
Oh, you attended?
Yeah, my wife got me tickets, the two of us tickets, because I listened to the NPR Politics Podcast to fall asleep. And so my wife got us tickets to go see
a
live. Maybe. It's true. This is what I'd like to listen to then. It was like my go-to podcast.
And you'd wake up in the morning refreshed.
I'd go to bed and have nightmares about things, about what's happening in the country. But
yeah,
like, you know.
I don't know. I think it would keep me
I'm
up.
An insane political junkie. And so I like their like 15 minutes. But then so she got me tickets and we went and saw
a live
podcast.
Did they do it
live
all the time or just was just a special?
No, just a special one. But what was funny is I remember being like, why would anybody go see a podcast taping?
And now you've done it 100 times.
And now I'm like, oh, yeah. People love it. It's like really fun. And now it's what we do. And so they were
but
my
we
first
only
one
have
that
power
I did.
Here right now.
That's true. All right. So listen to the NPR Politics Podcast only from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Do you ever look at political headlines and go, huh? Well, that's exactly why the NPR Politics Podcast exists. We're experts, not just on politics, but in making politics make sense. Every episode, we decode everything that happened in Washington and help you figure out what it all means. Give politics a chance with the NPR Politics Podcast, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so now I want to talk about the immigration bans, because last night the Trump administration once again issued a travel ban. It's like time is a flat circle. So this time it's for individuals from 19 different countries. It goes into effect on Monday and will fully restrict entry for individuals from one of 12 countries, including Afghanistan, Haiti, Iran, and Sudan, and will partially restrict entry for 7 other countries, including Cuba, Sierra Leone, and Venezuela. So obviously we all remember this was like the first thing Trump did
right.
in his first administration with the Muslim travel ban. And so do you remind us what happened with the litigation around that first go around?
Okay. So one of the first things they did when they came into office in 2017 was they issued the Muslim travel ban. It was pretty much everybody called it that. Everybody understood it to be that. The only countries that were listed in there were like 7 or 9, I forget how many, Islamic majority countries. And then it was a promise. It was essentially a campaign promise of Trump's from the 2016 campaign saying, we need to stop Muslims from coming into the country.
Till we figure out what the hell is going on.
And he made all sorts of inflammatory Islamophobic statements in anticipation of this. And that this was Steve Bannon wrote this, or whoever, I forget who wrote it, but I think Bannon had a lot to do with it. He was in the White House in January of 2017. And this was their effort to carry out the president's campaign promise. But the problem with that was it was very broad, had no exceptions, and it was basically clearly racially and religiously motivated,
right.
violative of the First Amendment. And really, it was really, really crass. So what they did was they got a lot of, heat for that. There was litigation commenced. And so they kind of issued a second order, which was a little cleaner, a little narrower. And then they issued a third order. And they issued the third order basically 8 months later. And the first two, because they kept revising the orders or withdrawing them, So the first two cases didn't go anywhere. Mm. The first challenges to the first two orders. The third one, they had created a record, and they had conducted studies through the State Department or the Homeland Security about what each country did to provide information to the United States that would allow the United States to verify the identity of the people coming from those countries and whether or not they were terrorists. And then they would study, like, you know, well, is there a higher incidence of terrorism from some countries than others? They did a whole analysis.
Yeah.
And I can't speak to whether or not it was a good analysis or a bad analysis. I know there was a debate at the time, but at least it was something. And not only that, they took off some countries, some Islamic countries, and they added Venezuela and North Korea. So it was no longer just Muslim countries. And then they also added lots of exceptions, and they added lots of, you could get waivers. They created a lot of, you know, it was a much more nuanced thing. So when it got to the Supreme Court, basically you had the challengers making the same pitch they wanted to make at the first order, which would have worked. I think the first one would have gotten struck down, which is why the Justice Department and the White House fixed it then when they were back into, like, trying to obey the law,
right,
at least to some extent. And so the plaintiffs came in and they said, look at all these statements that Trump made. And then the Supreme Court, the majority, it was 5-4, the majority basically said, well, look at the statute. And the statute does, there is a provision in the Immigration and Naturalization Act that basically says the president can exclude, foreigners or groups of foreigners as he sees fit to protect the national interest of the United States, something like it. It's just very, very broad language.
Yeah.
And so the Supreme Court was very, very hesitant on version 3 of the order to strike it down. But they did acknowledge some of the crazy stuff that Trump had said, and then they kind of dismissed it. They said, this is really kind of funny, actually. It says, but the issue before us is not whether to denounce the statements. It is instead the significance of those statements in reviewing a presidential directive neutral on its face, again, because it no longer just focused on Muslims, addressing a matter within the core of executive responsibility. In doing so, we must consider not only the statements of a particular president, but also the authority of the presidency itself. And so what they were basically saying is, yeah, we know this guy's an idiot and he said idiotic shit, but they clean this up enough and we don't want to say the president can't do this because a normal president could do this.
Right.
And so it's sort of interesting to look at that in retrospect. They were still, Trump was new. We hadn't gone through two impeachments, a coup, Hannibal Lecter, we name everything, and everything we've seen in the past several months. They were they want to, and understandably so, treat an administration as normal and giving it the benefit of the doubt, particularly when they actually seem to have done some work. Now, fast forward to the present.
Yes.
I think the order probably will stand, but again, they're going to end up, the people who are going to bring challenges to it, if they bring challenges to it, are going to pick this apart. It's not a Muslim ban order because it doesn't just focus on Islamic countries, but this new order does a lot of the things that you would expect to see if you're following this 2018 decision, which is it makes specific findings as to each country. I can't tell you whether the findings are bogus or not, and you can't really assume that these people are saying things that are truthful. But it has sort of on the surface, it looks like they are rationally trying to put together reasons why these people from these particular countries are being treated in particular ways. So if that, unless that's just shown to be completely bogus and there's a, they probably have created an administrative record that under Trump v. Hawaii, this 2018 decision would mean that the order would stand. On the other hand, I think that's probably how it comes up. But on the other hand, the same presumption of normality doesn't exist in the same form today because the Supreme Court has been watching these people just completely lie and abuse the process. And we've already seen some impatience and kind of really annoyance at the administration in some of these Alien Enemy Act cases, right, and immigration cases. And then you've got, which we'll probably talk about later, you have the question of whether or not the attacks on the conservative legal establishment might annoy some of the justices.
Yes, we will. We will talk a little bit about that. So the one thing on this, so I understand Trump doesn't like people from other countries coming here. President Miller, right. He does not like the others from outside. But the Afghan one strikes me as particularly cruel. Like,
yeah,
these are people, many of whom fought alongside Americans. Yeah. Or like, but what's he trying to do with this? Is it, you think it's just Stephen Miller, this is what he wants?
Look, I think they like to create, again, a lot of what they do is performative.
Yeah.
A lot of it's performative to make, like, create this perception of activity and energy that the people who are kind of only watching through the corner of their eyes or got Fox News on in the background think, oh, well, they're doing stuff that's great.
Yeah.
And then there's also just outright sadism. Yeah. Okay, involved. These people are mean. They want to, they feel that they're, I really do think that they feel that they are working out their resentments against the liberal establishment, the present order, the globalism, by victimizing people unnecessarily, on picking on them. I mean, like the renaming of the, I mean, this is kind of off topic, but the renaming of the Harvey Milk. I mean,
sure.
What's the point of that?
Right.
Right, it's just
so we're renaming the Harriet Tubman.
Yeah, no, we just want to make we just want to say F you to everybody.
Yeah, I don't think, and I'd be interested whether or not you think, but like I remember when that travel ban happened, and people were, lawyers were camping out there, Americans were incensed. Like that was the first,
yeah, it was
taste,
very,
right? But now
it was very chaotic.
I bet nobody does anything about this.
It was very chaotic,
yeah,
because the order was so broad. And it caught everybody by surprise because it was put together in a slapdash fashion very quickly. You know, on I don't know what day it was, but it was probably in January 2017, not long after the inauguration. And there was a lot of chaos created. Here, you've got a different environment. First of all, it's these – I mean, I haven't gone through this order. I would want to talk to an expert. But, there are some nuances in this order, like version 3 in 2018.
Right. Like they've learned some things.
Yeah. And also it's like, you want to come to the United States?
Yeah, right.
Okay. I mean, it's like a lot of people are just staying away.
Sure.
Now, that doesn't help people who are wanted to come, who would have otherwise wanted to come to the United States to avoid persecution, mm-hmm. you know, because they might have political asylum claims. But if you got a political asylum claim and you're one of these people that's mistreated in one of these countries, I don't think you want to come to the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd try to find somewhere else. So, that's another reason why, I mean, this may not be a focal point of a flashpoint for litigation, but we'll see.
Yeah. So not only did Trump issue this travel ban yesterday, but he also issued a proclamation called The Enhancing National Security by Addressing Risks at Harvard University.
Oh, my God.
So essentially, the administration said it would bar Harvard from participating in the student visa program. So new international Harvard students won't be admitted. And the State Department is contemplating revoking the visas of existing international students. This is just like straight up retaliation.
Yeah, no, this is absolutely straight up retaliation. And I think part of what they're trying to do here by issuing those proclamations basically simultaneously and citing the same statute, they cite a bunch of statutory provisions in both, but at its core, they're citing the statutory provision that allowed them to that the Supreme Court used to uphold the third travel ban in 2018. I think they're thinking, well, under the travel ban decision in 2018, this statute allows us to do anything we want in the name of national security, which is, as we've been talking here, basically a theme for a lot of the things that they've
yes.
been trying to do, including the executive orders against law firms. In this case, again, because it's really not directed at real security concerns about particular countries, although there's this noise about Chinese students coming to Harvard, but they come all over the country. I think you know, Judge this is going to go to Judge Burroughs in the District of Massachusetts. She has already said in a TRO that a temporary restraining order she's issued it basically that Harvard has basically shown a likelihood of success on its claim that it's being discriminated against. And it's hard to see how this should be treated any differently, even though the statutory authority is maybe broader and different. It's like, okay, you're really saying that Harvard's the only school you should be doing this to? I mean, the fact sheet that accompanies this particular executive order talks about holding Harvard accountable.
Sure.
Okay. It's like basically, why don't you just say retaliating against Harvard? You might as well just change the topic, be more honest.
Assume this gets struck down by the courts, but it does raise the question then. Okay, if it's going to get struck down by the courts, I don't know. They lose like 96% of the case. 96% of their cases they were ruled against in May.
Yeah.
What is the litigation strategy? Is it just like lose all the time, or are they trying to wear the courts down over time?
They're basically, look, you can, and this is a theme that I think we've talked about. I think we talked about it when we discussed, I think when I came fresh from Judge Howell's courtroom when the Perkins Coie order issued. It's like they can lose these cases, yet they can deter people. Right, they can deter law firms, even if the law firms aren't targeted by the EOs. They might be afraid of being targeted by the EOs, although there's been good news on that front, actually, in the press, and kind of censor themselves or not do certain things. Or they can, or Perkins Coie and these other law firms would win their cases and then still get jerked around in government agencies when they're trying to represent their clients. So basically the thing is like they just want to throw up roadblocks. They may lose, but you don't know. Maybe the students are going to decide it's not worth coming here. Maybe, even if Harvard says we won and they get visas, assuming the Trump administration follows the orders, like, do you really want to come to the United States where you don't know whether they're going to issue some other wacky order 3 weeks from now, and you've already moved your stuff into Cambridge, and then you're going to have to leave again, or you don't feel safe on the streets because some masked men are going to take you and haul you to a detention facility. It's like, there's an effect of all this bad faith acts and these illegal acts, and just keep piling on them, throwing stuff up against the wall or flooding the zone.
Yeah.
It has its effect even if they're struck down by the courts.
That makes so much sense. And I guess I hadn't quite thought about this as a PR tool. I mean, I can think of litigation, but like, I always think, well, boy, they're getting humiliated. They're never winning. Like, it's costly. It takes their time. But your point is,
they're just going to do something else, and then they're also going to attack the courts and just say these judges are all communists, even the ones Trump appointed, even the ones that Ronald Reagan appointed and George Bush appointed. They're communists, or they're globalists, or they're corrupt judges, and they're trying to usurp the powers of the presidency. And even the Federalist Society was in cahoots with these people.
Oh, we'll wait, talk about don't that. Preempt me no? on the Federalist okay, okay. Society. That's our candy at the end. All right, we're going to do one more. Yeah, we're going to do one more ad, and then we'll give you guys candy in a little bit. So anyone who knows me knows that I wear jeans basically everywhere I go. I will not put on hard pants. I'm always on the hunt for the perfect denim. And if you're
perfect?
I did say perfect.
You did say perfect.
And if you're a guy out there whose wardrobe is full of jeans but not the perfect jean, let me introduce you to our sponsor, the Perfect Jean.
Love them.
George, why are these jeans so perfect?
They are perfect because they are comfortable and they fit well. They come in very different, all sorts of like 10 or 12, I don't know how many different versions with different colors and any size you want. And they're really, really, really comfortable. They
are just absolutely comfortable. You're a big perfect jean guy.
I probably have like 15 pairs now.
Oh, that's a lot of jeans.
I know. I probably 90% of the time I go out of my apartment, I'm wearing perfect jeans.
Man. Well, a lot of the guys on my team are looking for comfortable jeans during our hot DC summers. I have to buy Barry jeans because he can't buy his own. And I know they've found the solution. Over 30,000 men have rated the perfect jean 5 stars. And with over 5,000 color, fit, sizing, jean combinations, you'll definitely find something perfect for you or for your dad. Father's Day is coming up. The perfect jean hasn't just perfected jeans, though. They have these buttery, soft, organic tees that make your arms and chest pop. Makes your arms and chest pop while slightly hiding that belly. Great news. So you can save the jean. You don't have to go to the gym tomorrow. You just get the shirt, hides your belly. Great advice. The perfect jean always has free shipping, exchanges, and returns, so you can have peace of mind knowing that your order is completely risk-free. So guys, it's finally time to stop wearing uncomfortable jeans by going to theperfectjean.nyc. Our listeners get 15% off your first order, plus free shipping, free returns, and free exchanges when you use code AskGeorge15. AskGeorge15.
See, the number's always
at checkout.
15.
That 15%. You have 15% off for new customers at theperfectjean.nyc with promo code AskGeorge15. After you purchase, they'll ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Fuck your khakis and get the perfect jean.
That's their slogan.
I don't usually drop the F-bombs on these podcasts, but...
They have the other one about, you know, how comfortable the jeans are for men in certain areas.
Is that right?
Yeah, I
forget what
it said.
I'm glad they didn't give me that one to
read. No.
You can do that one.
I forget what that line was, and probably better off leaving it instead.
So,
but they are comfortable. There's no question.
Yeah. 15 pairs, this guy.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk about Judge Boasberg, because we were talking about this earlier. So we've talked a bunch about the various litigation against the removal of Venezuelans to a prison in El Salvador under the Alien Enemies Act. Quick plug. Me, John Lovett, and Tim, we're doing a Crooked Bulwark crossover event. All the gays are coming together to do a live show on Friday, tomorrow.
I saw that. It's like you're selling tickets on Ticketmaster.
Because we're doing it as a fundraiser for Andre, who is the gay makeup artist.
Oh, who got sent to CCOP?
Yeah, who got deported.
Yeah, it's so outrageous.
Because they acted like he was a gang member because they mistook his tattoos, which his tattoos said mom and dad. And they decided he was an MS-13 member. And you found footage of him, as like lawyer has it, of him crying and trying to explain to them, like, he's a gay makeup artist, not a gang member. So we're going to hold a fundraiser for him. All the proceeds are going to his legal assist, and it's going to be a good time for a good cause. But so on Wednesday, a judge in one of these, you know, Alien Anime Act cases once again slammed the administration. Judge Boasberg wrote, "Perhaps the president lawfully invoked the Alien Enemies Act. Perhaps, moreover, defendants are correct that the plaintiffs are gang members. But, and this is the critical point, there is simply no way to know for sure, as the CCOT plaintiffs never had any opportunity to challenge the government's say-so. Defendants instead spirited away plane loads of people before any such challenge could be made, and now significant evidence has come to light indicating that many of those currently entombed in CCOT have no connection to the gang and thus languish in a foreign prison on flimsy, even frivolous accusations." The opinion also, my producer showed this to me, also goes on, it started with a paragraph quoting Kafka.
Kafka, yeah.
To underscore just how dystopian the government actions are. So.
Great opinion.
Yeah, tell me about the, because this is another one of those like barn burners.
Yeah, no, it's another great opinion. And this is one aspect of all of these immigration, Alien Enemy Act cases, whatever you want to call them. These cases present like a kaleidoscope of legal issues, and you can turn the case one way and you see one legal issue, you turn it the way other way, you see other legal issues. Like, you know, there's the question of whether the Alien Enemies Act applies. There's the question of due process, where the court basically says you just can't throw people out of the country. You have to give them written notice, you know, and they said where the notice question wasn't specifically, you know, be at issue. And what Judge Boasberg has done here is he's focused on the fact that the court in its emergency orders has basically unanimously agreed that people who are removed from the country, whether it be under the Alien Enemies Act or other alleged authorities under the Immigration or Naturalization Act or whatever you want to invoke, are required to notice and due process a hearing, notice and a hearing. And what the court said in the first time it hand, I think, took on this case, the JGG case, which is this is again Judge Boasberg. This was the case where they were spiriting people out in the middle of the night, and the planes were, you know, he said he issued an order and the planes then took off, and now he's investigating whether or not the government should be held in contempt. That ultimately went up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court basically said, on a technicality, said this should not have been brought as a class action. It should have been brought this is a claim that should have been brought in habeas corpus, which means it should have been brought in a different district. But now he's back with a class action that's not contesting whether or not these people are being unlawfully held, which means it's not a habeas claim. And again, you know, I could get technical about this and other people would explain it better. So this is a new claim strictly focused on, did these people get due process? Mm-hmm. And the court has basically said, you're required to give these people notice. It said that going forward, these people need notice. It said that in that JGG case. But logically, if it's a due process requirement to get notice, well, even the people who are in CECOT right now in El Salvador have due process claims. Because clearly they didn't have due process. So what he's basically saying is you violated their due process rights. It doesn't matter whether or not, I mean, you know, we may find out someday that the Alien Enemies Act was exceeded, which has been so held by a couple of courts. But you still got to give these people due process.
Yeah.
And the only way you remedy that is by creating a method by which they can be heard. And, you know, your fundraiser kind of plays into that because, you know, even though the gay makeup artist is in CECOT in El Salvador, you know, he's going to be able to have, if this decision holds, Judge Boasberg's decision holds, he's going to be able to have his day in court to show. And the government's going to have to.
And do they have to bring him back to do that? Get him out of there?
Well, you know, that's going to be an issue. I mean, the question is because, I mean, that's going to be an issue. I mean, you still have that another Supreme Court order basically saying that they have to facilitate the return of Abrego Garcia,
right,
which presumably applies to anybody who was removed in those batches of removals to CECOT. But I think he's going to get a hearing whether or not he gets sent back.
Yeah.
Okay. I think he's clearly entitled to that, and that's what Boasberg is saying. And it's hard for me to see how the Supreme Court can complain about that. And, you know, I unless they kind of totally accede to the proposition that, well, they violated this guy's these people's due process rights, including the makeup artist, and we can't do anything about that because President Trump says we can't get these people back. Okay, this is another way of going in.
Yeah,
and Boasberg did a very nice job, and it's going to be hard to overturn this because the court has basically said unanimously you are entitled to notice and a hearing before you get tossed out of the country, and these people were denied that. Full stop.
So this is good news.
Yeah.
And just because you brought this up earlier, and it's a good point to talk about it, do you feel like the Supreme Court is starting to get aggravated at the attacks on especially the conservative judges?
I hope so. And
Not that
it's good, but I mean the courts are being attacked, and the courts have basically been stalwart so far, including Republican judges, including Trump appointees. They've done a really, really good job saying, you know, not being deterred from saying that this administration is doing illegal stuff.
It's a good reminder that Eileen Cannon was an outlier and not representative of those judges.
No, and this is, again, we're getting to the candy, but the judges, you know, these were real lawyers that most of them that were appointed and believers in the rule of law that were appointed in the first Trump administration. You may not like some of their views about the law, but, you know,
Which is how it's supposed to be. Like, we should, regardless of the political affiliation of the presidents who appoint judges, there should be a lot of basic tenets on which they agree. That are constitutional.
The 14th Amendment talks about the rights of persons, not just citizens.
Yeah.
And the 14th Amendment talks about people born in the United States being citizens, regardless of what their parents' immigration status are.
Yep.
You know, these are things that really should not be in reasonable dispute. And the due process aspect of these Alien Enemy Acts cases is not in dispute, because you don't even hear Alito or Thomas raising a peep that these people, you know, aren't entitled to due process. Of course they are.
Okay, let's do our candy. Before we wrap, let's just talk briefly about what's happening between Trump and Leonard Leo. This made my week last week.
It made mine too.
Hey, everyone. If you want to catch the rest of this episode, then go become a Bulwark Plus subscriber. Click on that. Become a Bulwark Plus subscriber. Catch the rest of the show and support all the great work we do here at The Bulwark. Thanks, guys.
Well, George Conway, he's a man with a plan. Got to sit down with Sarah Longwell, take a stand, explain all the legal problems they're piling high. With Donald Trump, oh my, oh my, oh my. He said, Sarah, let me break it down for you. There's obstruction of justice, corruption too. The legal tangles and troubles, they're growing fast. It's a storm that's gonna last and last. Oh, Conway, tell them well about it. Those legal problems can't live without it. From the Ebola mess to the Russian ties. Oh, Sarah, listen close.